They're six of the most terrifying words in the publishing industry. I want to start a magazine, but what will you write about? And how will you pay for it? Well, the titles we're looking at today don't belong to a specific industry or to the world of fashion or politics. They're just about getting their ideas and images across to their readers. We'll be taking a closer look here on The Stack. On today's show, we're browsing a selection of titles that wear the thoughts and ideas of their independent publishers on their sleeves with pride.
These type of magazines I brought along today are at one end of that spectrum where, you know, they really are the mags that exist purely because someone wants to see them in the world.
Plus, how does an annual publication stay relevant all year round? We'll speak to the team behind New Zealand's Flint and Steel magazine.
This year we sit upon the theme of sustainability. People really just apply it to the environment. But actually sustainability is a wonderful and beautiful concept that we think should be applied to every part of human existence.
All that coming up on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up a little later on the show, we'll visit the home of fanzines in Melbourne as we explore the slightly unusual underworld of DIY fan-driven publishing. First, however, let me welcome my guest today, Steve Watson from Stack Magazines. He's a good friend of ours here at The Stack on Monocle 24. Steve, welcome to Midori House. Great to have you with us on The Stack, as always. The man from Stack Magazines on The Stack. It still pleases me. I don't know why.
You can get confused. You've got to be careful.
But no, I think our listeners, they're a savvy bunch. You've got some great magazines, which we're going to talk about a little later. And I guess the sort of, if there is a unifying thread, if you like, that binds them together, is the idea that maybe there are magazines that don't exist to serve an industry, serve a sector, serve their advertisers. They're there just because there's people who want to make the magazines and get their ideas out there. And I guess that's something very important for the independent magazine sector more broadly to kind of hang on to.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, so, you know, I guess if there's an idea to these magazines I've brought today, it is ideas. So they're, you know, kind of you can flip through them and you see that, you know, they don't really, for example, they're not movie magazines that exist within the movie industry or fashion magazines that exist as part of the fashion industry. They are literally there just to carry the kind of ideas and insights of their creators. And I think that, you know, that's something I find really interesting because in the independent side, you get people who are primarily publishing for passion. You know, they've got something they just want to say. And I think that these type of magazines I brought along today are at one end of that spectrum where, you know, they really are the mags that exist purely because someone wants to see them in the world.
Now, it's interesting because I guess some listeners will say, well, hang on a minute. You know, if you look at the independent sector, you sometimes get this where magazines can get a little, I don't know, indulgent. Maybe they don't have a strong editorial line that they need to stick to, or they don't have, advertisers, or, you know, they don't have maybe the same kind of commercial constraints that are governing them. Does that matter? I suppose it might. If it's done well, it doesn't matter.
This is the thing for me. I actually think that it's easy to kind of confuse and conflate these things. Mm. So when you get a magazine that is just out there because someone wants it to exist, and maybe they've found a way of funding it through their parents or whatever it is, that probably is not going to make for as interesting a magazine. But I think the great opportunity that we've got at the moment is this sort of like this, you know, mass democratization of publishing where anybody can get their stuff out there. And so that is kind of where there's this huge opportunity for lots of interesting ideas. And actually, you know, some of these magazines absolutely are going commercial concerns. And like, you know, they have proper offices and they employ proper teams of people. And some of them aren't. But I don't think that that's necessarily a good or a bad thing.
And just, I suppose we should say, given we're talking about that whole spectrum of magazines, if you have a magazine that's serving an industry or a sector, you think about the dozens or probably scores more even of, say, fashion titles. Mm. The fact that they are explicitly covering fashion and they're explicitly about fashion, similarly, that doesn't make them inherently less interesting or less good. And some of the very best work is in those sectors. So we're saying it's a broad church, I guess, is the point.
Exactly. And actually, the only, well, for me at least, the only deciding factor is just that, you know, kind of, does it ultimately hold your attention? Do you pick this mag up and an hour's gone by? Because obviously for the vast majority of titles, that's not the case. But I think when you do find that, it's quite a special thing.
Let's delve then into your stack of magazines, because as you said, there's some really interesting pieces here. Let's start with, is that Cabinet that you have
It
there?
Is Cabinet in this. I think kind of like when you're talking about this type of magazine, Cabinet, you know, they're kind of the masters. Like they've been doing it for so long now. I love the way that with Cabinet, like, you know, it is literally a cabinet of curiosities. It's this kind of like timeless piece of publishing that really kind of like digs down into stories that, I mean, first of all, you have never heard of these stories before. You would not think that you would be particularly interested in them, but the way that they present them with such kind of rigor and insight, I just absolutely love it. I mean, the danger with Cabinet for me is that, like, I have to be a little bit controlled, because you could just read Cabinet and not do much else, really.
Then we're getting an insight into Steve Watson's lost afternoons. That could be could be a regular radio feature. And I guess there is something about that. It's a degree of detail. And as you said, there is this sort of bringing together of esoterica, which takes you back to this kind of, you know, Victoriana collections and things like that. It's just something. Is it just because this is good editors picking great, compelling content? And again, we come back to sort of the purity of the idea. That's why that always works, right?
Yeah, there's real experience and skill here. Like, this is not people who have just had an idea and want to see if they can make it work. Like, you can tell that everyone here really knows what they're doing. I think another really special thing is like the sort of the feeling of a club. And, you know, thinking of like, this is something that I think all great magazines do. So, like, you know, when I think back to FHM in the 90s, which at the time was like my favourite mag, one of the great strengths was the way that they had this little club that you want to be part of. And Cabinet does exactly that, although obviously with a very different set of club values to 90s FHM.
We're going to be continuing to delve through Steve's stack later in the programme. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
On a typically humid, drizzly day in Auckland, Monocle's Claire Urban set off to visit the people behind an annual publication called Flint and Steel, which first appeared in the Monocle offices a few years ago after our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, brought it back from one of his many trips to New Zealand. Created by Maxim Institute, a public policy and research think tank, the minimal design and intimate photography throughout Flint and Steel makes it instantly engaging. Claire sat down with the magazine's editor, Jeremy Vargo.
Every year we were producing this little booklet basically called Winter Selection. It was just a piece of bound literature that contained essays, poetry, all that sort of stuff around a whole bunch of different issues that, you know, sort of friends of the organisation and our supporters and different people that we thought were pretty interesting would produce. We would send that out to our supporters, people that we thought would be interested. And then in 2013, our incoming communications manager looked at how much we were spending on it as an organisation. And obviously, you know, we didn't have any advertising. It was just absorbing those costs of printing and creating the piece, and just said, this is actually really great. She had come from a magazine background herself, and she said, this should be a magazine. And so the idea with Flint and Steel is to give a bit of space to discuss some complex ideas. Each issue of Flint and Steel is centered around one theme, and we try to make that theme coherent but also broad, so we can get a lot of different perspectives on the one idea. So the first year, our theme was national identity and belonging. So what does it mean to belong to a place? What constructs the identity of a nation and of the people who live there? So we brought in perspectives from people who had, you know, just immigrated to New Zealand, people whose parents had immigrated to New Zealand and they had grown up as first generation New Zealanders. We brought in academics who talked about the history of New Zealand, our biculturalism, the tense nature of the relationship between Māori and Pākehā New Zealanders, and what needed to be done in order to reconcile that. This year we set upon the theme of sustainability, because it's definitely a word that is tossed around a lot, and it's a beautiful idea. But we think that most of the time people really just apply it to the environment or to things relating to nature and protecting nature from the excesses of human ambition. But actually, sustainability is a wonderful and beautiful concept that we think should be applied to every part of human existence. So, I mean, we went to people like Sir Peter Sharples, who has just come out of Parliament, has lived the most unbelievable life working with Māori to actually recreate and reclaim a lot of Māori identity. And so him talking about sustainability, him discussing what it means for Māori to sustain their identity, we just thought that was phenomenal.
You speak about bringing in people to talk about things. Let's talk a little bit about who contributes to the magazine. Where are these words coming from? Who are the voices? And how are you sourcing them?
So what we do is, once we've got the theme, the editor of the magazine has to spend the next wee while just actually looking at who's been writing about this, who's been speaking about this, thinking quite tangentially about, well, who would be interesting to hear talk about this? So you've got the idea of who's already speaking about it, but also who could we encourage to speak about this for the first time that would actually be really interesting. The people we bring into the magazine, we sort of have a rule that we have to agree with probably around about 60 to 80% of what they say. We try to source perspectives from people who we respect. Even if we would disagree with some of the things they would say, we need to respect the level of thinking and the sort of level of commitment they've had to the area before we sort of want to offer them, you know, a place. We sort of saw Flint and Steel as being an output that was sort of for the sort of general public and kind of a layperson, but yet we've had probably more engagement from political leaders and from people in policy and ministries. You know, we featured people in the social enterprise scene last year. We had three different people from, you know, sort of upper echelons of government get in touch with us and just say, oh, could you give me their contact details? Because that person sounds amazing. I'd like to talk to them because we're trying to get policy right in this area. It just goes to show that when you invest in really beautiful work, you know, that you think, oh, well, you know, people need things to be beautiful for, you know, to get engaged in deeper issues if they're not already interested in them. Actually, people who probably should be reading 50-page reports for their job actually still really respond to beautiful magazines like Flint and Steel, because it's actually written in a way that's supposed to engage.
How much of Maxim Institute's work, aside from the magazine, influences the magazine or is told through the magazine?
The magazine is kind of like a separate research area of our work. So we have research areas, like I said, with education, poverty, and the magazine we really see as an output of our communications strategy. So it's not about communicating any one particular area of our work. So we won't do a magazine that's themed on poverty or themed directly on economics, because we just think we're already covering that with our research. The magazine is kind of a place for us to sort of play around with the other ideas that we really care about. So, you know, sustainability, social business, what does it mean for the economy to meet people where they're at and to meet human need? So it's tangentially related to a lot of the areas that we want to focus on, but it's about finding different expressions, and that's why we love to invite other writers to come into this work, because we don't just want to hear ourselves. You know, we want people to be attracted and also confronted by different ideas and differing voices within the same magazine, because if you want people to think deeply about a certain issue, you can't just have everyone singing from the same song sheet. You've got to be able to look at the complexity and look at the difficulty, and also look at the benefits that come from the different perspectives that we find in the magazine. Part of the ethos about choosing a magazine, about investing into paper and print and, you know, photography and colour and long form essays, is that there is something about sitting down with a physical copy, and it's not just about the information, but it's about the posture that you take when you sit down with the information. It's about what you're presenting co-located. So with a magazine, it's actually, once you put it to print, it's there permanently. You've managed to actually put your ideas into someone's living room where someone's going to pick it up, or you put it into a cafe where someone is going to encounter it by chance. And I really love that.
That was Jeremy Vargo, editor of Flint and Steel. and also communications manager of Maxim Institute, talking to Monocle's Claire Aban in Auckland. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Steve Watson still with me from Stack Magazines, the subscription service that curates some of the very best in the world of independent publishing and delivers it to your door each month. Steve, we've been talking about the ideas side, I guess, and the ideas that drive the best in independent publishing. We're looking through your stack of magazines. Bite Me.
Excuse me, Tom.
The programme's not taking a turn for the worst. This is a Hong Kong publication, and it's the next one that you're going to be telling us
about.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So Bite Me, this just arrived with me last week. And the first, so this is issue three. The first issue was The Butt. So it was stories revolving around bottoms. The second issue was Hair. And for this issue, they've gone for Mouth. Everything they do with this magazine is so visceral. It's so, like, you know, kind of, there are so many close-up shots of, like, mouths with sort of, like, spitty saliva around them and stuff. And it's, like, it's kind of, like, uncomfortable, but also completely fascinating. And again, like, you know, a magazine that you look at this and you think, well, this only exists because somebody sitting in Hong Kong had this particular desire and urge to make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some more sort of challenging fashion shoots would say, oh, this is relatively tame. But it's, you know, it's not the edgiest stuff out there, but it's definitely, it's prompting, it's probing, it's asking some kind of interesting questions.
For me, it's about the curation. So it's a very visual magazine. So there's actually, I generally prefer magazines with a bit more to read in there than this. But so for me, it's all about the images that they are choosing to bring together and why they're doing that. And there's also, there are a couple of pieces in there that I think they're doing something quite kind of like difficult and subversive with the layout of the page, where you're not entirely sure where to start reading from. And it kind of, it just so happens that this story is about learning to kiss from the internet. And so you get this kind of like very sweet and kind of anecdotal story about growing up and learning to kiss, like, from the movies. But actually the way it's presented is in this fairly challenging sort of like way, with there are like phone screens with Google searches on them, and like that. Yeah, I think they're doing something interesting with that.
Fascinating stuff. That's Bite Me from Hong Kong. Let's continue our magazine meander this week, Steve. Where should we go next?
Okay, so next up is another brand new one. This is A Magazine, published here in London. And it's A Magazine as in atypical. So kind of using the A prefix for something that is not kind of as you'd expect and conventional. Mm. It's made by a creative agency.
Is that Naked?
Naked, there you go. Naked Communications, yeah. And I think, you know, this is kind of, there are lots of agencies that have grown out of magazines. So, you know, kind of you get a mag like, say, Little White Lies, which then sort of like births the Church of London. This one seems to be going the opposite direction, where you've got an agency set up and they're creating something to sort of like give us a bit of like a calling card. But I mean, in terms of like the typography, some really great stuff in there. The prints and the kind of like, it's got that sort of exposed binding. I think it was printed at Ditto Press. Again, like, you know, they've really gone all out on this and just presented this collection of interesting, sometimes slightly odd, slightly difficult ideas.
Now, I wonder, because as you said, this certainly, it looks the part, it feels the part, and, you know, it even kind of smells the part. Is this one of these things where that's great because it's a kind of, it is atypical, it's slightly experimental, but presumably, are we going to get a series of magazines? How challenging does it become to think completely outside the box and not be bound by any editorial diktats if you're doing this, say, I don't know, 3 times or half a dozen times or 10 times?
Yeah,
it's quite an interesting question to ask,
I guess. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could certainly see this as a quarterly magazine. Mm. It's fairly slim. I think that, you know, kind of if you've got like your agency full of people who are like, you know, working away all day on like the corporate projects, this sort of thing probably would go down fairly well in terms of like, okay, let's make something for ourselves, but brackets, also to go and like give out to clients.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think you make, or there's a risk of making a rod for your own back if you position yourselves as being, well, in this case, you know, atypical, because it's quite hard to not follow any conventions or traditions, or even inadvertently, perhaps.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a difficult, in a way, you're setting the bar quite high, I suppose, creatively. Almost.
That is a good point. There is a story in there which mentions Bon Passant Par. And I like Bon Passant Par joins urban beekeeping for me in terms
in,
of like
in your ubiquitous corner.
The number of independent magazine stories I've seen that refer to Bompas and Power, and they do interesting stuff, and like, that's not to say that you shouldn't, but I guess to your point about like being atypical,
That's getting into typical, maybe. We could say,
but come on, I mean, that's like one part of one story.
Exactly.
I think we'll give them a break.
It's still a pretty good job. What's at the bottom of your pile of magazines today? I'm not suggesting that's for any reason of selection or anything. It just happens to be the last one. Tell us what we've got here.
Okay, so this is by no means the least. This is last. It's Harvard Design Magazine, and this is a magazine that I think they're on like issue 41 or something now. But I've never seen it before. And this is one of the things that like I just love about independent publishing, is that even someone like me who spends their entire working week with their head in independent magazines, like something like this can come along, who knows how long it's been around for, and I'm only just finding it. Again, it's one of these magazines that's absolutely jam-packed with ideas. It's made out of the Harvard Design Graduate School. And so, you know, kind of as you'd expect, there are a lot of big brains contributing to this. Their theme for this one is family planning, which they take in a very sort of broad sense to literally mean like what families are and the way that we live in units.
Right.
But I read this over the weekend, and this is one of the ones that I completely lost myself to. It's just absolutely fascinating stuff, and very much kind of in the mode of Cabinet, where you don't know you're interested in this kind of thing until you start reading. And I think there's such a skill of presenting relatively difficult ideas in a way that is approachable and so digestible that it just draws people in.
Well, as you say, and one thing that is particularly striking is, number 41, and you suddenly think, oh my God, there's a vast archive. There's hours more. There's many more lost afternoons ahead for Steve Watson. What about just describing it? Do you know, so presumably you said it's the first one you've seen. You haven't, I don't know if you've now looked
I've
up
been
any
online. I've looked at some other covers.
Is it kind of a identifiable family look each well, is it monthly or
no, I think it's quarterly or even biannual, because that says fall winter there, so I'm guessing maybe biannual. So they redesigned a few issues ago, and they now have kind of like, so it's a very knocked back cover. It's like sort of a wood grain with like a green sort of like tint that fades over it. And that's something that they carry through their issues. So it's in the same shape with the same kind of like tints. I mean, as I said, the theme of this issue is family planning. And it looks, to all intents and purposes, like a family planning textbook, which gave my wife cause for question what I was doing this weekend. But, you know, that for me is that it just kind of adds to the sort of like the firecracker, like the, you know, the here's this kind of like very unassuming looking thing. And you open it up and it's absolutely packed with these mad ideas and really interesting stuff.
And I suppose it speaks to this, another old idea we've talked about, which is that if you do things with conviction, if particularly if there's great writing, in some respects, you can kind of hedge around the conventional idea that, you know, the cover image is everything and that it must broadcast what it's going to do, you know, outwardly. Because, as you said, you would certainly not garner the depth and the complexity of this from a glance at newsstand.
Absolutely. Well, and I guess the key point is that I doubt this is on newsstand. I would think this is probably sent out to alumni and interesting people who Harvard particularly want to influence.
Opinion formers,
there you go.
That's how you got your hands on a copy, isn't it?
And then they also send copies to idiots like me. But that's kind of, you know, yes, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, when you're freed from the shackles of having to have a big headline and having to sort of like shout to people, you can do this other stuff.
Brilliant stuff. The insights of Steve Watson with his stack of magazines. Steve's from Stack Magazines. With us on the Stack, Steve, lovely to see you. Thanks very much for coming to see us as always.
Cheers. Thanks, Tom.
And before the end of today's edition of The Stack, we're taking a trip underground to a store located deep beneath Melbourne's Flinders Street station. Since 2001, Sticky Institute's proudly boasted of its commitment to defending zine culture. With over 12,000 self-published zine titles tucked away on its shelves, there's scarcely a topic imaginable that's not mentioned. And as Monocle contributor Stephen A. Russell discovered, the voices behind fanzines and fanfiction often approach their product with a ferocious sense of commitment. Here's Sticky Institute's Beck Vincey on the role of the zine specialist and how her intense dislike of 50 Shades of Grey inspired her own zine creation.
Do you have any interests outside of work?
What about you? I'd like to know more about you.
There's really not much to know about me. Look at me.
I am.
In Defense of Fanfiction started out as a bit of a joke, I guess, between myself and some friends. When 50 Shades came out, there was a bit of uproar about it. I'm like, this sounds like the worst thing that's ever happened. I'm going to read it. I read it within 24 hours, and I was so mad because it's such a bad book and it's such a bad example of fanfiction that I went home and I sat down and I, like, wrote everything out. It's kind of, like, a very passionate or, like, aggressive essay about the relations between fanfiction and what 50 Shades of Grey is and why it fails the whole medium. And then I shelved it because I was embarrassed that I'd written more than 10,000 words on 50 Shades of Grey in a day. And I put it away, and one of my friends, Sam, was like, no, you have to publish it. I want to read it. So I sat on it for 6 months. And I went back and I edited it down to under 9,000 words because I wouldn't allow myself to be so upset that I would write more than 9,000 words about 50 Shades of Grey because it didn't really feel like it deserved that much attention. I'm one of three coordinators of Sticky Institute. We're located in the De Grave subway in Melbourne. We've been there for 14 years now. And it's basically an artist-run space. It's all volunteer-run, run by and for the zine community in Melbourne. So we stock zines there, and only zines. I started going to Sticky when I was in high school. I was about 15 years old when we discovered it, and it was a really nice place and a great environment for someone who is a teenager and is trying to get into art but isn't really sure what they want to do, but also kind of likes writing. Like, it's a very mishmash kind of place, and because it's a working space as well as, like, a stockist, you know, I wanted to be part of that community because you walk in there and you feel like you've come home. It's like a little lounge room, you know, everyone there is really nice, everyone wants to help you. It's a great way to meet other people in the community, and I just really wanted to be a part of it and help perpetuate that for other teenagers coming up through high school or Melbourne or whatever. I just thought it was so great that I wanted to make sure it stuck around for other people. One of my friends, Christina, writes punk fanzines, so she goes out, she reviews shows, she interviews her favourite bands, and she's always putting a lot of hers together. And I, even though I'm not that into punk music, I really like her dedication and how she's still keeping, like, the traditional punk fanzine alive in that sense. Fanzines definitely have a home in, like, the sci-fi community and the punk community, and they're still going strong today. Like, they're still making zines, they're still great, they're so traditional. You know, it's beautiful to see that it's the tradition has carried on.
That was Beck Vincey at Melbourne's Sticky Institute, located inside the marvellous old De Graves Street subway. And that is more or less all we've got time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer Ben Ryland, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor Claire Arban. Comments or queries are welcome as ever. Drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next weekend. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for listening.